So I told you last week in passing that whatever you expected Chain of Command Part 2 to be, it probably wasn't going to be what you expected. Did you expect
this?
It
wasn't quite.
Okay.
That Picard would essentially get Abu Ghraib on him. Now, I didn't know it would go so far, and relatively for the time especially, it was a fairly graphic scene. Maybe it was just a little more so because this is Picard getting tortured, but... But beyond that, yeah, the rest of the episode seemed just kind of, I don't know. I don't feel like the plot in this episode was particularly interesting, even though it was all fine.
Right.
And there were no surprise twists. There were no, you know, last minute reversals. It didn't turn out that this was all for anything particularly interesting or, I don't know. Like, it turned out all they wanted was just, hey, we want to know the Federation military secrets, and, you know, the Federation just happened to be one step ahead with their switching the captains, and that was it, right? Like, that's...
Pretty much, yeah.
That's all their plot was, and...
But I think if you
look
at it...
That's not interesting.
Well, yeah, I don't think so, but I think if you look at it in terms of a message episode about how bad torture is, I think it works a little better, and it's certainly something that I think is still relevant today, obviously.
It's a yes and no thing in the fact that, I mean... I don't know. I think the average person doesn't think torture is a good thing, but yeah, maybe this is, yeah.
You would be very wrong, Richard.
Okay. Yeah, it's weird because torture seems so beyond the pale for
well,
me.
Well,
that...
as an aside to the audience, Richard doesn't pay attention to the news at all. Richard actually, I believe, thinks that George W. Bush is still president. So, yeah, a majority...
Things were so much better during his time.
A majority of Americans, if you believe the polls, are okay with torture.
Really?
Number one, yes. Ugh. So, that yeah, it's gross. I agree with you. So, I think that in that context, you know, episodes like Chain of Command Part 2... Are still necessary. I think that, you know, whatever the timing was in 1993 for this, I'm not really sure. I do know that Patrick Stewart was heavily involved with Amnesty International, so I don't know if that had something to do with it.
Certainly.
And, you know, I think it's remarkable because when you see torture on television or in the movies, normally it's that sort of, you know, standard generic Hollywood torture, which isn't what torture is actually like. And I think one of the good things about the episode is that, you know, the torture scenes with Captain Picard are very difficult to watch, and they're also pretty accurate as far as I know.
Well, it's,
you know,
very
especially
dehumanizing more than anything. That's the...
It's, well, yeah, but I mean also, you know, the stress positions, which is something that America has done in the recent past and probably still is doing. I don't know. You know, it's all very disturbing, you know, and so I think that having Captain Picard in that situation stripped of his clothing and basically being hung up like a slab of meat overnight is it says something. I don't know what, but we'll find out, right? That's what the point of the show is.
Okay, yeah. I can agree with you. I
mean, as an episode, I think it's not that great. I think that you're right. The plot is not very interesting. I think they made... In the first part of the episode, you know, we talked about how Jellicoe was a capable captain. He was, you made the point of saying, like, he's just basically a wartime captain and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, he's just a very different captain from Picard. And I think in this episode, they sort of step back from that a little bit and they sort of make him a little more incompetent, which I don't really like.
Well, they do and they don't, because, I mean, what I found the most interesting thing about this episode is that pretty much at the end of the episode, they have all this, you know, they realize, you know, Picard is there, that, you know, they're trying to figure it out, and Jellicoe comes with a plan that's very militarily strategic. In other words, this is a case where, you know, it really does boil down to who has the bigger stick, and Jellicoe has the trump card at the end, and his plan works perfectly. There is no, like I said, there's no last-minute twist or reversal. I mean, nothing goes wrong with Jellicoe's plan, and I guess when it comes to a, you know, more of a stealthy diplomacy, which is when they're in the conference room, he's not as good as that. He has I mean, there's the scene where he's saying, you know, okay, well, now you go back and you say that, you know, I'm angry, and, you know, and then we'll tell them this, and, you know, and it's this, like, little kid plan almost, and, you know, Troy says himself, like, he's not confident in himself at all.
Right.
He's not good at that part. But when it comes to doing, again, a gun and, you know, positions maneuver, he comes up with a brilliant plan that works perfectly.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that, you know, that's probably the episode's, you know, I like the fact that they make Jellicoe competent in that way. You know, and I think they had to contrast him, of course, with Picard and make him not as good at the diplomacy, because otherwise, you know, why isn't he captain of the Enterprise?
Yeah, if the situation were reversed and it was Jellicoe being tortured and Picard in that conference room, I'm sure it would have been an extremely different outcome.
Right.
It would have ended in the conference room.
But I guess, you know, I don't know. I think that you know, I mentioned last week that this wasn't intended to be a two-parter, and they did that partially because they wanted to save some money. So using the same sets over two episodes and all that kind of stuff. So I think that I'm not really sure that, and this is a problem that the Next Generation has had with two-parters in the past in general, which is that I'm never really sure that the setup is worth the follow-up.
Yeah.
They set up a lot of stuff, and nothing is ever really answered. I think that, you know, there's implications, or it's strongly hinted, that Admiral Nechayev and Jellicoe and Starfleet Command, you know, have some sort of temporary plan in place for why they put Jellicoe in command of the Enterprise.
Yeah, I think they realized that. I think they got the sense that the sense I got was that they knew that the Cardassians were planning some kind of plot to kidnap whoever was in the Enterprise, because as they correctly assume, the Enterprise would be the flagship in that sector.
Well, no, I don't think that they thought that he was going to get kidnapped.
I don't know. They knew that they were, but they I don't know. Their plan specifically is foiled because they put Jellicoe in charge of that. Again, maybe they just thought that there would be a battle.
You mean the Cardassians?
Yeah.
That was the Cardassians' plan. I'm talking about what Admiral Nechayev and Jellicoe and Starfleet Command were doing.
I guess it's maybe as simple as they realized that there was about to be some kind of action
I guess to me, if you're putting Captain Picard on a secret mission because he's only one of three people in Starfleet and the other two have left for whatever reason, that know something about metagenic weapons, why would you want to make it extremely obvious that Captain Picard is not captain of the Enterprise? You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't seem to make much sense to me.
And that's the other thing, you know, the Cardassians don't seem to, you know, the Cardassians are foiled because they don't realize that, you know, Picard is not in command of the Enterprise right now. But they make a point of saying, you know, well, they went through the ceremony, you know, they do all of that. So.
Yeah, there seemed to be another layer or another piece of this plot that was missing. That they just didn't come up with a satisfactory explanation for a lot of this. And at the very end of the episode, when Picard comes back and Jellicoe hands command over the Enterprise to him again, it's like, what was all this for?
Yeah, again, so. And this, I think, does have to do with it being a two-parter, because especially the two-parters we've seen, whether you like them or not, whether they were good or not, they at least had some kind of, you know, wow factor. Again, something like Best of Both Worlds, that one's obvious. Even Time's Arrow is this big, you know, costumer plot and, you know, back in the day, you know, when you have reunification is, you know, that's the Spock episode, and that's, you know, Vulcan and Romulus, you know, they're big episodes. So this you expect to be, all right, it's a two-parter, it's going to see something very high stakes, and it's a fine, you know, interesting plot, but for the most part, it's not big enough. The stakes aren't big enough for it to be. If they really were developing this metagenic weapon, and, okay, the Cardassians could kill every, you know, planet, okay, that would be high stakes, but it turns out that's a ruse, and it's just to get generic military information.
Yeah, and it's also strange because the Cardassians, their whole plan is they're going to set up this metagenic weapon thing, which doesn't exist, so that Picard comes, and then they're going to kidnap him and get the information they need to invade this system or whatever.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, but you're right, that's not...
It seems like it would have been easier for them to actually have developed the metagenic weapon.
Or why not just invade in general? Like, I'm not really... You know what I mean? So that all seems kind of perfunctory in a way.
But this had been a one-part episode...
Oh, I think it would have worked well.
Because, all right, so if their plan didn't 100% line up well, that's fine, you know, it wasn't... By making it a two-part, they seem to make it's a bigger deal, and I think it invites more scrutiny in a way.
But I think on the other hand, maybe it's, you know, I'll play devil's advocate here and say maybe it's actually nice because it kind of, you know, the Cardassians will go to these lengths to kidnap one person to get minor military intelligence and torture him. Maybe that was for a reason. It's to paint them as the type of people that will develop a fake weapon to kidnap someone and torture them.
Well, again, if this is... you know, I was talking about the timing between this and DS9 where the Cardassians apparently are a huge deal. I mean, this may just be introducing the Cardassians to the next generation crowd, you know, people who aren't sure if they want to watch DS9 or not. Well, this is the kind of plots we're going to have, maybe. I mean, maybe it's as simple as that, or here's the big villain of that series. You know, we've had a couple of – because you said this is the – this is kind of what they are like for the most part, as opposed to their earlier. You know, this is the kinks are worked out, and this is going to be your next. This is the next Klingon. This is the next, you know, Borg. This is the next Romulans.
And they do set up some things. I mean, you know, we're kind of skating around the torture scenes, and we'll have to talk about that at some point. But I think that they do set up some background information for the Cardassians, which we haven't heard before, about, you know, the military is in command of their government and all these kind of things. So that is stuff that becomes important, especially in Deep Space Nine. So that's interesting.
And there's a bit of an ambivalence about the military being the government in a way. Like he's, you know, the main one feels that I think there's the feeling that the military is a necessary evil. The Cardassians seem to feel that they are beset on all sides and need to have a very strong military in a way to defend and protect themselves. And maybe conquest is a proactive method of defense in their way. I get that sense. So it feels like he wishes that this weren't the case, and it's terrible. But at the same time, what other choice do we have?
Well, let's talk about the torture, because I have a major question about the efficacy of this episode, and that is this: is he actually good at his job?
He doesn't break Picard.
He seems kind of bad at this. You know, he lets personal information out to let Picard get at him.
Yeah,
he doesn't break Picard. And so to me, it's like, is he good at this?
He seems to have a...
maybe nobody can be good at torture because torture doesn't work. I don't know. I don't know.
A lot of it is... I mean, I am comparing this episode in my head to the torture episode of Babylon 5, which is probably one of that series' best episodes. Now, you saw that more recently than I did, but... I would say that that's an episode where the characters aren't broken, but the torturer doesn't come off as, in a way, not good at his job. Like it's
well, I'm, yeah. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to bring that up as well.
Yeah.
And sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but you know, I kind of feel like maybe they should have doubled down on the torture and just made this 45 minutes of torture.
Which is why, again, the Babylon 5 episode is so effective, because it literally is just – that's the entire scene. It's, I think, takes place entirely within the room, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
I guess what I think is the most revealing thing about the torturers in the Star Trek episode seems so, in a way, pathetic is because at the very end, even as he knows that, you know, Picard is released, you know, they're about to, you know, he's spending these last 2 minutes just desperately, pathetically trying to break him. And it seems almost that, you see, he's proving something to himself.
Yeah.
Because Picard is, like I said, you said he lets personal information slip and or personal, you know, kind of his feelings slip, and Picard immediately... Again, when he basically says, like, look, you know, no matter what you are, you're a weak person, you know, and all of that. The torturer knows that, and his last 2 minutes with Picard are, if he can break him now, well, then that's not true. And so in a way, Picard being released and not breaking is – Picard is the one who ends up torturing the torturer more. Which I think is interesting.
Yeah.
You could see he's going to know this for the rest of his life. No matter what he is, he's going to know that he is ultimately weak and bad at, you know, he's not as good as the Federation. He's lesser in a way.
I mean,
I don't know.
I can see that. And I think that that's interesting on a plot level, or maybe it's satisfying in the sense that Picard is our hero and we don't want to see Picard broken. But it seems at odds with the message of the episode, which is that torture is dehumanizing and torture should never be done.
Well, maybe Picard, you know...
You know, there's
well, maybe there's a difference then when I'm saying, you know, Picard tortures the torturer. Maybe that's not the right turn of phrase. I guess it's
I don't know. It's that sort of like...
Picard defeats him, but non, you know, not in a very strong and confident way, in a way. And meanwhile... The Cardassian is using torture as a very blunt method, as a terrible method, as an ineffective method, because that's all he has. He has no true strength, and it's Picard who is using his insight and in his own inner strength and all of those things, and he has his own ideals, and he knows that they're right, and he, in a way, wins by having – he wins a moral victory more than anything.
Well, and I guess – I don't know. I mean, because I think that there's a couple things going on there. Number one, of course, is that the torture is completely unnecessary, because Picard even says that, you know, the very beginning of the episode is them giving Picard a drug to make him tell them what they want to know. And so they know what Picard knows.
Yeah.
And the torture is just sort of a superfluous – meanness, in a sense, right? Or superfluous
evil.
Again,
it's an act of desperation. They have nothing else to do.
Well, no, it's not. It's not even an act of desperation.
Well,
completely not necessary.
I'd
like,
say,
there's
like,
no
again,
reason for it whatsoever, except he wants to torture someone.
He's bored and sadistic.
Right.
There's nothing else he can get from Picard, nothing to do. So what else is he going to do? He's just going to torture him just because that's all I think he can really think of to do.
Right, but I don't think that the episode sells that. And I think that it would have been a stronger message if it said, here's a guy who's doing his job and he's frustrated. And maybe that's what they were trying to do with him, with the daughter, and letting some information slip. But, you know, here's a guy who's just doing his job, and this is how people do bad things, right? Is they kind of slip into it instead of making a conscious decision to do it. And so... I don't know. I feel like the message that torture is bad in this episode is very muddled, because of course torture is bad. And that's something that we need to be told.
Well, maybe this episode just doesn't really have a clear moral. And I think that's because it doesn't really have a clear plot. So we don't know what information he's hoping to get from Picard or what he's hoping to do, because there's no real, again, he has no information and we don't know what their plot really is. So the torture does doubly seem like a superfluous, unnecessary, you know, just, again, sadistic event. But
yeah, they need to
they needed
to come up with some reason for why he's doing it, and they never do.
I feel like, you know, if you're saying the message is torture is bad, I think you're pointing that out as the message, not because it is the episode's message, but because the episode doesn't really have a message. It just kind of is there, and torture is bad is the closest thing to a reason that we're here in this episode.
Well, I think that you know, summing it up as torture is bad is perhaps a bit unfair to the episode, because I do think that everybody that was involved in the episode was very earnestly trying to make an episode to show people that torture is bad, right? I do think that.
I mean, I would say it's less about torture being bad and maybe just showing that – maybe making it really clear that these Kardashians just – I don't know what it is. I don't know any name or anything like that.
Cardassian.
I know. Well, it's really hard to say that because the media has trained me. Maybe it's just that the Cardassians are so evil that they torture, and they also torture ineffectively and sadistically and for no real reason, and that's who these people are.
Sure, sure. And I think that is something that's set up that's dealt with a lot better in Deep Space Nine, and I'll leave it there.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, in terms of this episode, it doesn't work. That's all I'm saying.
I think that we're both coming at the same basic point on two angles. Like, this was a fine episode. It had some good moments. If the torture scenes were to make, you know, if the purpose was to make me uncomfortable, it made me uncomfortable. If the purpose was to make me feel like, good for Captain Picard, you didn't, you know, break at the end, it did that. If it gave me the satisfaction of at the end seeing him talking to Troy, and in a way, I like that the show deals with this very seriously, because yes, anybody, any officer, any person who is tortured will need to speak to a psychologist for a while about that. And I like that they follow up on that.
Well, I think, and I think there's a couple other things there, which is that number one, you know, to the point about the episode being muddled about what exactly it's about, you know, Picard at one point says that torture has never been a reliable means of extracting information. And number one, I think that that information is not relevant, because I think even if torture did work, we shouldn't do it. Do you know what I mean? Like if killing my dog would cure cancer, like, I don't know that I would do it. Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. Yeah.
Well, that's a bad example, but you know what I mean? Like, doing something bad in the service of something good is not.
Yeah. That's the, I don't think that was the intention of the line, but I can see how the line could be twisted to be interpreted as suggesting that, well, in this universe, torture is morally wrong because it's non-useful. Like, there is a,
it,
again,
but it, I don't you, believe you can that, make and I don't it, think the show believes it. And that's, no, that's why I think the it line opens is it so up, problematic.
It opens it up to a utilitarian justification.
Right. I have a problem with that,
because,
number one.
Yeah, you could find one case where people's lives were saved because some information was tortured out. And
right, and that's always a justification for it, as, well, torture is bad, but it works, and so we need to do it. I you know, I don't think so, and I think the episode would have been stronger if they had not even introduced that idea.
Fair.
I also think that, frankly, you know, the romantic idea of the human spirit, you know, sort of, you know, you may break my body, but you're never going to break my spirit kind of stuff. I just have a problem with that. I feel like it's nonsense.
It's fair.
You know, if I'm being tortured and someone is telling me, tell me there's five lights, I'm telling you there's five lights.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the episode ends on that note, though, because as he's talking to Troy, he's saying, like, I saw five lights. You know, I would have said anything. Like, I would have done that. Yeah, I mean,
it's... But he didn't say it. That's the thing. That's what I don't like about the episode, is that, yeah, Picard is able to admit that in the privacy of his own ready room to his therapist. But in the moment when he says torture has never been a reliable means of extracting information, and we know that people will say anything under torture, that... It doesn't ring true to me that Picard is able to be like, I am a strong person with a force of will, and I am going to, you know, it's just, I don't like it. It's a weird confluence of too Hollywood and not very not Hollywood. Like, the torture scenes are done very well and they're very realistic, but there's still a neatness and a patness and a sort of nicety to some of the sort of, you know, subtextual things going on here that I don't appreciate.
Well, let me ask, I mean... Again, that's I guess it's a two episode problem. Maybe that they felt that they had to, in a way, there was no, you know, if whether or not we want to go into limitations and creativity and all of that, I feel like if they had to consolidate it into one episode, it would have had to have been sharper and more focused, and then maybe we could have gotten a more, you know, because they have two episodes worth of space in here, it just kind of does anything they build up in the first episode just doesn't get satisfactorily paid off in the second.
Well, and frankly, I don't think that I don't think that there would have been room for any sort of torture in a one episode version of this story. So,
or it would have been very greatly abbreviated and not the point of it, you know?
Right. And so you have one scene of Picard being tortured. Well, that's worse than having no scenes of Picard being tortured in a way. I think that you need, if you're going to do this in a way to make it realistic and to get across some sort of point, I think you need to give the torture room to breathe in a way. So I guess in that sense, it's good that it's a two-parter, but it's just, I don't know. It's very sloppy in a way.
Yeah, this is a sloppy episode.
And I think the other thing too that I think we've exhausted everything we can say about the torture, but I think that the other thing I don't like about the episode is that, you know, after last week where I said that I appreciated the fact that Riker and Jellicoe had different command styles and just didn't get along because they had different working styles and they didn't make it personal. They make it personal in this episode. And I think that that's a fundamental misreading of what was going on and what they set up in the first episode.
So, I mean, were they written by the same people?
I think so.
Yeah, because it does seem like there's – because, yeah, so Riker's plot basically, and maybe this is a way of getting out of the torture bits, which I don't think we're really coming to any necessary point on, but –
But I think that says something about
what the episode is trying to say anyway. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's this bit where they need someone to fly the shuttle, and the only person who could fly it is Riker. Like, that's very neat. That's very convenient.
Right.
That's very – I see why the episode had to do that, because – maybe this episode is a little too – I don't know. don't know. It's a little too gung-ho in certain bits. As I said, Hollywood and not Hollywood.
Right.
You have this non-Hollywood understanding that there are two people with very different commanding styles, and one's not going to see them, and they're not going to see the merits of each other necessarily, because again, they're looking for, again, what we see in Riker as, you know, he loves this place. He's in a position where he, you know, can really do the most interesting stuff and all of that kind of stuff.
Right.
As the first officer, he's a little closer to the action than Picard, you know, all of those things. We know the reasons that Riker is not a captain yet, but to all of those, you know, to Jello, they look like laziness. They look like lack of ambition. That's interesting, but just making it seem like, you know, but at the end of the day, Jello got to appreciate Riker because he did the mission.
I mean, you know, look, to the episode's credit, I think the episode in Riker's quarters with Riker and Jellico is good. And I think that what Jellico says is very well written. And I think what Riker retorts is very well written. I just think that it would have been more interesting if it hadn't been made personal, because making it personal is just like, I don't like your stupid face. Like, that's just, you know, I mean, that's not interesting. And, you know, the past five seasons have been about a Starfleet in a universe where people are able to work together, even though they might not necessarily like each other. And so to me, it seems like it's a step back for the show to say, well, here's a captain that is letting his own personal feelings about someone cloud his judgment in a way. And I don't like it.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of not what the show has been about.
I mean, I'm thinking of even like early Barclay play episodes, like the first one where, you know, Geordi didn't really like having, you know, Barclay around, but, you know, he also recognized, you know, what he, and I mean, maybe he needed some help getting to that, but generally they have the, you work together, you know, even if you have different outlooks on life, you have to come to, we all are working towards the same, we're all Federation people. We all have the same underlying goals, even if we disagree on the methods, and let's talk it out.
You know? Right. And frankly, it makes Jellico seem reckless because, you know, changing the captain of a ship, number one, is a huge change. And then, you know, relieving the first officer of command is another huge change because he's basically the person who keeps the ship running.
Yeah. I mean, like,
so that just makes that makes Jellico seem extremely reckless and incompetent, frankly. Maybe that was their intention. I don't know. But I don't think that was sold. You know, I don't think that was sold if you look at the first part of this two-parter.
Yeah. It just seems like he's one of those people. He just kind of probably ran through the ranks because he had some very good military type of victories. But he excels more as a tactical officer or, you know, some security type of position than he would as a captain, maybe. I mean, maybe that's it. You know, again, when he has to come up with a plan for, you know, how do we have the bigger stick, he comes up with an excellent one.
Yeah. And he never gets an opportunity to be humanized in any way.
Yeah.
I mean, aside from the fact that he has a kid and he puts his drawings up in his ready room.
But I mean, here's the thing, like, that, you know, the Cardassian officer has a kid and, you know, who he loves very much, and, you know, doing it once, humanizing a person by "I love my child" is fine, but this episode does it twice and in the pretty much the same exact way, and you know, it's diminishing returns.
It's diminishing returns, you know. Yeah, but I also think that there could be an alternate explanation for the Cardassian child, which is that that's not his child at all, and that's just an actor. Like, I kind of get the feeling that, like, maybe that, you know what I mean? Like, that's, they have, like, a child on staff.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
That they act like they're their kid, you know? Because I don't think that anyone would actually do that.
But the, you know, the thing from my view, though, like, they don't use that to torture Picard in any way. Like, you know, that would, because actually, frankly, that's kind of the chink in the Cardassian's armor, really. That's where Picard starts to dig and get to him.
Right.
It's the kind of, like, if they were torturing Jellico and, you know, suddenly they had a little cute boy Cardassian Moppet and, you know, I love my child, I do everything for him, you know. Gee, hasn't it been a while since you've seen yours? Gee, I wonder what he would think about it. You know, like that would be, very frankly, I think the whole experience would have broken Jellico very quickly, I think.
Oh, I think so. But I also think that, you know, now that you say that, it makes me wonder if, you know, perhaps that scene was supposed to kind of point out that they may not know Picard as well as they think they do, because Picard doesn't like children.
Yeah, he doesn't, you know,
So Picard's not really going. Picard believes in sort of the decency of everybody, regardless of whether or not the fact that they have a 9-year-old they need to take care of. So it doesn't. It's not a way to get to Picard in a sense. Yeah,
and so I get and may. Then maybe this whole episode makes the Cardassians seem a little bit less informed than they think they are. And I think in – because, again, they don't know that Picard is not really the captain of the Enterprise and doesn't have this information. You know, they might not recognize that – you know, they don't have a dossier on this guy, which is surprising because you would think that they would be able to very easily get his biography. Yeah. But
– just go to – Cardassian Wikipedia.
I mean, you know, Cardassians have met Picard.
Right.
Like, they've right. talked to him. They've, you know...
Well, maybe that's... I mean, maybe...
So, in a way, it makes the Cardassians seem not unlucky, or the Federation is just that tiny bit better, or the Federation just, by sheer happenstance, or, you know, by luck of the draw, managed to get through this one, which would make the Cardassians seem like very tough but beatable enemies to... Well, they made a couple of major mistakes.
Well, yeah, but let me posit an alternate explanation for that, which is that maybe that's really maybe one of the points of the episode is that torturers and sort of organizations that torture don't do the legwork necessary because they think that torture is going to get them what they need. So maybe that's, you know, sort of like another layer to it, which is that the sloppiness is intended because they think that the torture is all they need to do it. When you rely on bad ways to get information, you're going to get sloppy and you're going to fail.
This whole thing, I feel like we've thought about that a lot more than, that theme.
Maybe,
that,
I don't
like,
know.
I think
but...
this isn't, again, one of those episodes where we're positing a better written version of this episode because that would be
–
that. I think that would be very – I don't know necessarily that this particular text supports that particular reading.
Maybe.
And I would be very interested in a version of this episode that supports that.
That's fair.
So that episode gets an 8, but this one only gets a 6.
Yeah, I'll give this one a 5. It's average at best. Although I do want to say one other thing, which is that Data does not look good in a red uniform.
No.
Let's move on to Ship in a Bottle.
So this is one of Pa Goodness's favorite episodes.
Okay.
And, I mean, it's a Moriarty episode. It's a Barclay episode. But I hated it less than I thought I would.
I like this episode a lot.
It's
and I want to say that, number one, I want to ask you, were you surprised that they waited this long? Like, because I know that you sort of like had a question about Moriarty way back when we talked about Elementary Dear Data. Like, is he, what's up with him? Is he coming back? And I kind of was like, eh. And now here we are 4 years later and he's back.
It's really funny. This episode reminds me of Wrath of Khan a lot.
All right.
Because as you can imagine, so, you know, a villain has come out of stasis, something that the captain didn't necessarily do complete due diligence on, and yet ending completely differently. You know, I don't know. It was, I think this was a much better version of this episode than I could have predicted.
It's very well done.
I think it gives a very satisfying resolution to the Moriarty arc, which has been, I mean, this is like the third episode this is a theme that's been going on as far as I believe the first season, even with this holodeck and what can the holodeck create and do holodeck creations have a life outside of that, you know, was Minuet alive, is
right,
you know, all of those things. And I think this episode, I think that there's some directorial bits of this episode that I didn't like. I didn't think it was quite clear where we were in certain times, like whether we were on the real ship, the holodeck ship, and even worse than, you know, I know the episode wants to keep some ambiguity about that, but
I think I actually disagree with you a lot. I think that it's, you know, the direction works brilliantly, and I think that there are a lot of subtle clues if you really know you're looking for. You know, for example, things like they don't show an exterior shot of the Enterprise until like well into the episode to indicate that they never left the holodeck. I think that They do a good job of indicating to us as soon as we have the information. Like it's a hard episode because I think that it's a mystery that mostly mysteries are predicated on the characters having less information than the audience.
Yeah.
But this one is predicated on the ideas that the characters and the audience have pretty much the same information. And so there's a couple points in the episode. You know, the big twist of the episode, of course, is that Picard, Data, and Barclay never left the holodeck. Which, did you see that coming, number one?
No.
Okay, so it was effective. Well, and then also I think that, you know, it so I think once that information is brought across, and I think once they sort of build their alternate plan to put Moriarty in a holodeck inside a holodeck inside a holodeck or whatever they do. Yeah, it does get a bit, you know, convoluted and it does get a bit confusing, but I think the episode does about as good a job as it could at keeping all of that consistent.
And I have to say, we've talked a lot about certain mystery episodes, and there have been a lot of episodes that I've liked and you haven't liked as much because you know what the twist is or whatever, and what the solution is, and you know, watching the episode the second time, it's not as... This may be an episode that actually works better off the second time.
That could be, yeah.
I actually would like to watch this again, you know, knowing where everything's going and knowing why everyone's acting as they are and, you know, those kind of things might make it more interesting.
Yeah.
That said, this was a really good episode. I like this one.
Well, it's very... I mean, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's very well written. It's very well acted. You know, Moriarty is a fun character.
I mean, yeah, if the whole thing wasn't, you know, it had a hell of a lot of good scenes. I love the Countess.
Yeah, she's great, isn't
she's
she?
Like she's hilarious. She got to wear trousers for an entire month,
you know. I yeah, I think so. And I think that, you know, in the sixth season the show has been doing, I think, a better job with the female characters.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure why that is. But, you know, they finally got Troy in a regular uniform, yeah. And they have the Countess. So
and Crusher's been really good lately.
So I think that they're maybe doing a bit of a better job with them for whatever reason. I also, you know, I think that it, you know, the sort of comparison to Wrath of Khan, I think, is interesting because I think in a similar way to how Kirk forgot about Khan, I think the episode makes it pretty clear that Picard is covering his ass as hard as he can when he goes to meet Moriarty, because of course he...
I mean, we all forgot about Moriarty.
Right, we all forgot about Moriarty. Like, I really feel like I don't think that anyone ever thought that they were going to revisit this.
Yeah, I can imagine people watching this, you know, episode, you know, when it first aired, and the longtime fans like, oh, holy shit, they're picking that up.
Yeah, like, why is this coming back all of a sudden? Mm-hmm. You know, and of course it came back because there was some misunderstandings about the Sherlock Holmes estate, and we talked about that way back when we talked about Elementary Dear Data. But, you know, basically they thought that the character of Sherlock Holmes was in the public domain, and it turns out that Sherlock Holmes is not in the public domain, and so they thought that the Sherlock Holmes estate was mad at them or something, so they didn't do it for a long time. And someone finally got the idea to do this episode, and they went to the Sherlock Holmes estate, and they were like, yeah, you can do it. Here, just give us some money, and you can do it. And they're like, oh, okay, we'll do it then.
I was like, do they have people on staff at these things to, like, check these things up?
Yeah.
Okay.
So maybe they fired them and got somebody else after they filmed Elementary Dear Data, because, wow, that was a big mistake. You know, like, if you send a script to your research department and they're like, well, actually, you know, Sherlock Holmes is not in the public domain, so you guys are going to have to pay for this. Yeah, that could be a problem. But yeah, I think that, you know, they make Moriarty believably ahead of Picard and Data.
Yeah.
But not in a way that makes him a supervillain, which I like.
Yeah. He's not so much. And again, in the beginning of the episode, it seems almost like he does have these powers. Oh, he can get off the holodeck. He is able to take over the computer. How is he doing that? And, you know, I think they do a good job of... I feel like my opinion of this episode is, you know, getting happy, you know, better as it's going on. But, you know, I think the episode is very good at misdirecting into... We're asking the questions of, well, how did he do that? Is, you know, what's happening, that the actual answer, well, he didn't at all, is, you know, comes out of nowhere. That's very clever. It's a very clever episode, but I don't mean that in a damning way. Like,
it's very clever in a satisfying way.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't make the audience feel stupid for not catching it. It sort of makes them feel like they're in on the fun, which I like.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, like when he steps off the holodeck, it is a holy shit moment. You're like, what exactly is going on here? And what I like about it is that when Data finally figures out that they never left the holodeck, they don't really spend a lot of time like retracing their steps or figuring out exactly, you know what I mean? Like, they're just kind of like, well, how do we get out of this? And they come up with this plan off screen and it works. And I think that, you know, yeah, it's a little unclear as to what exactly their plan is. I agree with you in that sense. But I think that if you've followed the episode to this point, you can kind of pick up on, you know, what exactly it is that they're doing to some degree.
See, it's really interesting because I think this, I've, as has been obvious, I really love the way this series treats, you know, artificial life and, you know, artificial intelligence and all this. And this is, the little cargo bots or whatever they were called in the, you know, last week.
The exocomps.
The exocomps.
Comps.
Exocomps. I thought it was exocom because they exo means out and com means we communicated with.
No.
What does comp mean?
I don't know. Computer.
Oh, wow. That's impressive.
Maybe. I don't know.
And I like that the episode ends with them figuring out how to preserve even the Moriarty life form, which they, at this point, you know, at the beginning of the series, the idea of a self-aware computer that counts as a life form was a little strange. They weren't even sure in the PI one. What one is this? The big something or other?
The big goodbye?
In the big goodbye. They're not even sure whether, you know, oh, they leave a kind – they're almost surprised at the idea that he's saying, well, you know, what's going to happen to me, you know, am I, you know, when they tell him that he's a computer program. And then you have Measure of a Man, which they legally prove that, you know, a self-aware computer system is a person. And they've been going further and further on this. So at this point, the thought that Moriarty is a life form that is self-aware, that is sentient, isn't a big stretch for them. And I like how the characters' philosophies have evolved towards that over the season, the series.
Yeah.
I think that's a very serious treatment of the series' own themes, which is that we're trying to seek new life and understand new life and accept new life. And I think that's actually kind of nice, and they come up with a solution which, you know, allows Moriarty to escape with his girlfriend, his dignity, and feeling like, ha, I won. I got out in the end. And I think that's very – I liked that a lot. I think it's a – the ending was a very nice way of resolving this this threat.
Well, I think the ending feels earned.
Yeah.
You know, and I think in a way that all good endings should feel. And, you know, the sort of machinations of what exactly it is they're doing and why they're doing it. I mean, you know, if you're really paying attention to the episode and you're kind of staying with the episode as it's unfolding, you know, you can kind of pick up pretty quickly that what they're saying is completely simplistic. And it's just, you know, they're coming up with an explanation that sounds good to Moriarty and doesn't really work because it doesn't have to work. You know what I mean? And so, like, yeah, let's uncouple the Heisenberg compensators and then we magic you out and then we give you a shuttlecraft. And it's like, I don't think that they would do this.
Yeah, because I kind of figured like that when he was talking about that to Riker, right? What I thought was going on was it was a Corbomite maneuver. Like, I thought he's making something up and that's really code and Riker's going to know exactly what he means. And there is no Heisenberg uncouplers and, you know, again, another really well done act of misdirection, especially because a couple weeks ago we saw Riker doing a kind of patter like that with the Ferengi when he's trying to reprogram the computer.
Right. I think to your point about Moriarty and artificial life and that you like the fact that they are respecting it, yeah, okay, that's all fine. But I guess, you know, this episode raises a lot of questions that it doesn't really answer, and I don't think that I'm not criticizing the episode for not answering those questions because it's not the point of the episode, but and this is sort of questions that Star Trek will revisit over and over again later. But the holodeck, again, is very sort of problematic, and this episode goes, I think, further than we've ever gone before into sort of explaining the nature of what the holodeck is doing exactly. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you can create a sentient artificial life form that easily, is this good technology, or is this sort of very, very problematic technology that perhaps should be put a hold on?
The series,
because, you know, Picard has a lot of good objections to Moriarty, especially when he wants to give his Countess sentience. And I think that the episode is going in a direction to kind of talk about that a little bit.
I like that the holodecks, they started really pretty much deconstructing the holodeck the second it appeared in the series. They created this, you know, very striking and fascinating technology, and the entire time they've been worried about its implications. And maybe that's actually one of the reasons I like this series too much, so much, and why it is feels very human, because a lot of the technology, they do really consider the implications of most of the technology that they have made. A lot of sci-fi, and I'll just have this bangwiz, gee, this is great, you know, type of stuff. And without really questioning, well, this requires payment in a way. You know, you need to give up something in order to get this, or this might cause an unforeseen problem. Where a lesser series, I think, would create the holodeck and would just, you know, hey, wacky adventures. And there are episodes of the series that do just do that, you know.
Right.
Schisms doesn't really question the use of the holodeck in its holodeck scene, even though that's one of my favorite holodeck scenes.
Well, the holodeck, the difference is that in Schisms, the holodeck is a tool.
Yeah.
And in this episode, the holodeck is, I don't know what, a sort of metaphysical reality?
Well, I mean, that's, frankly, the exocomps, same thing. They're created as a tool, but a behavior emerges from it that's not necessarily foreseen. In a way, I think the series a lot of times says, you know, there will be consequences to decisions you make or things you do or things you make or
unintended consequences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can't run away from that because it's going to come back worse and really haunt you. And, you know, I mean, this goes back to, you know, Wesley fucks up the Enterprise and, you know, has to tell his mom at the end. You know, I mean, it's that was a very simplistic version of this theme in the series, but, you know, in general, it's about, I think the series is about owning up to and using all of this responsibly. I mean, this is a series that emphasizes our responsibility to others very strongly.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's a good way to put it. And I do think that Moriarty's creation, of course, was an accident.
Yeah.
And so, and in the preceding, you know, in the intervening 4 years, they have not created another sentient artificial life form. So,
yeah.
So maybe this isn't as much of a problem as it seems to be. But I think that, you know, putting...
The point is they did.
The point is they did. And also the point is that they did it again.
Yeah.
Or Moriarty did it. I don't know exactly what happened there. But I guess the bigger question is, of course, does having a holodeck character act like they're aware that the real world exists? Does that actually mean that they're intelligent or sentient? Like, you know, there's a sort of like shortcutting to the episode, which is that, wait, you know, you're on a holodeck. Oh my God, you must be like an actual person. But you could program a holodeck to say those things. It's not really like, do you know what I mean?
In a way, it's almost like saying, you know, well, you know, we're self-aware that, you know, we're living in New York City, you know, and that there's a country called China, you know, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we're Chinese.
Sure.
I don't know what that metaphor really got away from me.
I don't. Yeah. I'm not sure where that was going.
Good
try, though.
Thank you. I guess being aware of the larger world doesn't mean that they're of it. And in a way,
I think you're missing my point, which is the bigger point is that they say they're aware of the outside world, but are they actually aware of the outside world, or are they just programmed to say it?
Well, that's the measure of, we need to have a measure of a man style trial for the Countess, really.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Moriarty to that effect.
Yeah. 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 And yet I think that's in a way a reason I like the ending better, because, you know, they can leave the question open for obvious reasons. Number one, we haven't done this in the world. We have not done this. We've done certainly many experiments with artificial intelligence. And even since this episode was written, but we don't have a Moriarty. It will be a while before we get a Moriarty for, you know, various reasons. So, I mean, this does remain speculative, of course, but then what it is speculating about is, of course, our own consciousness. And, well, how do we know that we're self-aware? Well, that's one of the things that philosophers have been debating for centuries, you know, in thousands of years. You know,
right.
It's one of the first questions. And so, I mean, let's face it, Moriarty even, you know, quotes, you know, I think, therefore I am. You know, that's a very basic philosophical principle.
Yeah.
And so I guess giving them – giving artificially intelligent people an artificially generated universe is a kind of a way of dodging the question in a way that's not unsatisfying or doesn't feel like a cop-out, but which basically right. says, well, we can't really know, but they'll be happy here.
Yeah. And I think also it's a – you know, at least on a plot level, you know, it's – satisfying because it allows the characters to
ride off into the sunset and well, have a cool line.
Well, I'm thinking about Picard and I'm thinking about Data and I'm thinking about Barclay because, of course, you know, there's a sort of, you know, I guess a sort of humanity to the episode, which is that, you know, well, why should we hurt these people
yeah.
in quotes or not unnecessarily if we don't have to?
Yeah.
You know, there is a solution here. And yes, they have to sort of trick Moriarty, and in effect they're putting him in some sort of prison, but they're not really.
Yeah, they're putting him in a very pretty cage in a way, but no, in a way they create a nature preserve for a life form that's
yeah.
designed to, you know, fully meet the creature's needs, a habitat that will be exactly what he and she want and can thrive in.
And there's a difference between, I guess, Moriarty, you know, because there's when at the very beginning of the episode, we think Moriarty has left the holodeck and Picard is in 10 forward with him and blah, 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 you know, and later on, once you know that Moriarty made that up and is playing Picard yeah. to a degree, and Picard gets, you know, extracts a concession out of him, which is, you know, well, you know, criminal activity is not tolerated,
yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. Moriarty is a criminal. Like, I, you know what I mean? Like there's also like a little bit of a sort of, it needs to happen for the episode to work, but there's a bit of an ignoring of the fact that Moriarty has already committed a couple of crimes. And then in the course of the episode commits a couple more. Like, do you know what I mean? And so it almost feels like he's being rewarded for being a jerk.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, you know, what's you just say, you know, it's kind of a prison. So, I mean, maybe it is, and maybe he does deserve a prison, but at the other point, maybe he deserves as nice of a prison as they can make, because it doesn't hurt Picard to give him this procedurally generated universe that's just going to go on forever and just be happy. And why torture the guy? I mean, I think he can.
Nice choice of words, Richard.
Hey, I think he can. I think they recognize that he is acting out of desperation and love, and they can at least appreciate that. And that, you know, at the end of the day, everyone did the right thing, and, you know, here we go. Let's all be – now we're all happy. They find an ending that makes everyone happy, frankly.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, you do get the nice ending where they're all in the observation lounge and they're like, oh, I don't know. Could you really tell the difference between the real world or a holodeck?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, Barclay's role in this episode is interesting.
Yeah, because Barclay is not – yes, he's much more socially awkward character than everyone else is. He always will be, but – that's not what this episode is about. He's a very minor character in this episode.
Well, it seems to me that, I mean, I don't know if this is true or not, but it seems to me that they put Barclay in the episode because they needed someone who wasn't there
yeah.
when Moriarty was turned on.
I think that's a...
Do you know what I mean? And so, like, that's why he's there. And it's not, I mean, it's not a Barclay episode.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I like that they're able to use him in this manner, you know, in a way where
Well, it fleshes out the universe a little
yeah,
more.
Yeah, and it fleshes out Barclay in the sense that the past few episodes we've seen him getting better.
Yeah.
And so frankly, while he is still socially awkward, he's been working with Troy. He's been working on it himself. He's doing that ear pounding thing and
– plexing.
He's been plexing. And so really he can have an uninteresting minor role in an episode now because he's okay.
Yeah.
You know, like he can just – do his routine things and be on a little adventure without completely freaking out and derailing everybody.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, so I like him now.
Okay. Well, I will give this episode
eight trousers.
Ships in a bottle.
I will give it 7 trousers.
Okay. So if you would like to share your thoughts about this, either one of these episodes, just go to trekaboutshow.com and leave a comment on the post for this episode. You can follow us on Twitter. It's very exciting. Trek About Show. You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekaboutshow and leave us a review on iTunes. Next week, we are talking about Aquiel and Face of the Enemy.
Okay, I know one of those episodes.
Oh, good.